Welcome to Issues and Ideas. I'm your host, Brian Lanzone. Coming up on today's program, Marisa Waddell talks with Director of the Morro Bay National Estuary Program, Adrian Harris. The NEP has just launched a fundraising campaign, and we'll hear about the organization's plans for the proceeds, their goals and current work, and threats to the estuary. Also, on another edition of Ears on Art, we hear from New Mexico metalsmith Gary Griffin. He has received two National Endowment for the Arts grants, exhibited around the world, and spent decades as an educator and artist in residence. But first, it's picking time for wines in vineyards in Paso Robles, and the farmers are bringing in a rich harvest. But as vineyards proliferate around Paso, residential wells are starting to go dry. Some are calling the plight of Paso Robles a good example of what's wrong with the state's unregulated water supply. Chris Richard reports.
Denise Smith's well suddenly went dry in June, and she's been trucking in water ever since. She's gotten showers down to 45 seconds. There are plastic buckets in her bathtub and in all the sinks, so she can use water twice, and as much as possible, she eats off paper plates. She uses the dishwasher once a week.
If I even use the water, you know, it's just turning on real quick and like this. I keep a bucket here and put my silverware in there and stuff before I put it into the dishwasher.
But there's been nothing she can do for her garden. She had corn, pumpkins, tomatoes, fruit trees. Now, when she touches the leaves of her plants, they crumble. Like many of her neighbors, Smith posted Save Our Wells placards along the road by her house. Also, like her neighbors, she blames Paso Robles wine vineyards.
They just keep planting more and more, and the wells are going deeper, and the water usage is so much that, you know, it's taken all the water from people.
Until fairly recently, cattle ranching, grain, and especially almonds dominated the local farm economy. But the energy crisis of the 1970s drove up the cost of pumping irrigation water from the ground. Farmers needed a crop that commanded a high enough price to pay those energy bills. It turns out that Paso Robles, with its warm days and cool nights, is prime wine grape country. At the Pomar Junction Vineyard and Winery, 10 miles southwest of Denise Smith's bone-dry yard, the vines are thriving. With harvest underway, seventh-generation farmer Dana Merrill plucks a bunch of small, deep purple fruit. Do you like grapes?
Yeah, this is these are Syrah, and they're 24-25% sugar.
Wine grapes were godsend. I mean, literally, we would not be in agriculture if it wasn't for wine grapes, because the other crops just aren't economically viable in this area anymore.
Local grapes bring as much as $2,000 a ton, three times the state average. Farmers here irrigate from the Paso Robles groundwater basin, subterranean beds of sand and gravel that hold one of California's largest water supplies. People thought they'd never run out. But with agriculture and development booming, water levels started dropping. To keep water flowing, a property owner can dig a deeper well, but that can cost at least $30,000, and lots of people say they can't afford it. That troubles vineyard owner Kathleen Moss. To minimize her own pumping, she's installed a $250,000 recycling system. When she washes her grapes, the system uses gravity to run wastewater through a series of filtration tanks and back into storage for irrigation. It hurt her feelings when a neighbor with a dry household well put up a sign blaming the vineyards.
I didn't take her water, and I wouldn't want to. You know, I'm doing everything I can to conserve. I tore out my lawn at home, and we'll continue to pursue every avenue we can. And yet, there's just no way it can be one single source who's responsible for all of this.
It's true that Paso Robles' population has tripled in recent years, and a thriving tourist trade draws on groundwater as well. Still, farms use about two-thirds of the water. San Luis Obispo County supervisors have imposed an emergency ban on all kinds of new wells. But right now, they lack legal authority to limit how much owners of existing wells can pump.
That's the tragedy of the commons.
County Supervisor Adam Hill is referring to the classic explanation in economics of how people use more than their share for short-term gain. And that hurts everybody.
That's the problem that we're faced with now, and that I believe more and more of California counties are going to be faced with if they're not already.
County authorities, farmers, and homeowner representatives are trying to establish a local water management district that could monitor usage, pipe in a new supply, and set up water recycling and storage facilities. Richard Frank, director of the California Environmental Law and Policy Center at UC Davis, says such districts can be effective.
But that is very hit and miss. And the problem is that hydrology and groundwater don't follow political boundaries. And then it gets difficult, if not impossible, for local jurisdictions to manage groundwater that they share with jurisdictions outside of their own.
In Arizona, Colorado, and New Mexico, anybody who wants to extract groundwater needs a state permit. And state regulators monitor pumping. Texas has administrative regions that govern entire aquifers. In California, the state legislative analyst's office has twice recommended similar systems. Meanwhile, overpumping is depleting groundwater throughout the state. UC Irvine professor Jay Famiglietti is using satellites to track the damage caused by unrestricted pumping in the Central Valley.
That region is losing about 3 cubic kilometers of water a year. So every dozen or so years, we're losing about the full volume of Lake Mead's worth of groundwater.
California relies on subterranean aquifers for about a third of its water supply, and even more in drought years. Famiglietti likens California's current lack of systematic regulation to a family that fails to monitor withdrawals from its bank account. If that goes on too long, he says, the checks will start to bounce. For the California Report, I'm Chris Richard in Paso Robles.
This is Issues and Ideas on listener-supported KCBX. Still to come on today's program, Chrissa Hewitt visits with New Mexico metalsmith Gary Griffin. But up next, Marisa Waddell talks with director of the Morro Bay National Estuary Program about the organization's recently launched fundraising campaign.
I'm Marisa Waddell with you on Issues and Ideas. Estuaries are where fresh water from streams and rivers meet salt water from the ocean, making some of the richest habitats in the world. Morro Bay is an estuary, and it's one of the very few pristine estuaries left on the West Coast. But keeping it pristine takes a lot of work on the part of regulators and volunteers and nonprofit organizations like the Morro Bay National Estuary Program. The executive director of the Morro Bay NEP is with me today, Adrienne Harris. Welcome.
Thank you.
I'd like to know, first off, why are estuaries so special and so worth preserving?
So you kind of already touched on it. Estuaries are such a diverse ecosystem. So you've maybe heard that rainforests and coral reefs have really high biodiversity. That's the, all the different kinds of creatures that are living in them. Well, same thing for estuaries. In particular, in the eelgrass beds that we have in our area, it's the grasses that grow there. There's all kinds of critters living there. And it really becomes this nursery ground for fish and other organisms. So some of the fish that we love to eat, that the fishermen catch offshore, actually spend part of their lives in our estuaries.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and Morro Bay in particular, why is it so unique?
Like you said, it is one of the few estuaries along the Central Coast, and luckily it's been fairly protected, and so it's pretty healthy compared to some of the other areas in California.
And so tell me, what would change in my life if Morro Bay were not protected? How does it directly affect me?
So many people living around Morro Bay and in San Luis Obispo, you know, spend some time in Morro Bay recreating. Lots of people like to kayak, boat there. So that would be impacted, as well as, you know, the fish that we eat. If you're a person who likes seafood like I am, your estuary being polluted makes it difficult for you. We have oyster farmers in the bay, and their livelihood directly depends on the bay. So my staff and I, we like to say that a clean and healthy estuary really impacts the local economy, the health of our local economy, the health of our citizens. So in the 70s and 80s, there was plans to try and develop quite a bit more in Morro Bay than has been thus far. And a number of the local community members got together and they said, we want to protect this area. We don't want to see this become another Newport Beach like in Southern California. Mm-hmm. And so they banded together and they helped form the National Estuary Program in Morro Bay. And they actually petitioned the national government to create a nationally designated estuary program. There's only 28 in the country. So that also makes us very unique.
Now, Morro Bay is a really important spot on the flyway for birds, right? Mm-hmm. The Pacific Coast Flyway. hundreds of species stop in Morro Bay every year. I know because I have friends who do the bird count every year.
Yes, and we have the very popular bird festival in the wintertime in February. You're right, there are hundreds and hundreds of species that spend part of the winter in Morro Bay, going from South America all the way up to the Arctic Circle.
Tell me about the mission of the Morro Bay National Estuary Program. Mm-hmm.
So simply put, we're there to protect and restore the bay. And so we do work in three areas. We do monitoring and research to try and see how healthy is the bay and is that health changing over time. Mm-hmm. We also do conservation work and restoration work to conserve natural areas around the bay and in the watershed, because everything we do on land eventually impacts our bays. And then the third thing that we do is we educate citizens on how to be better stewards.
How do you do that? You bring organizations and people together to do your work. Who is it that you're bringing together?
Estuary programs around the country, ours and our partners, one of the things that we try and do is bring a whole bunch of people together to protect the environment. So we are talking to local government, state government, national government. We're talking to other nonprofit organizations that do environmental work. We're talking to local citizens, local landowners like ranchers and farmers, trying to bring the whole community together to protect the bay.
What's your personal story? Why are you involved?
So actually, this week is my third anniversary of living in the Central Coast. Luckily, I got to come here 3 years ago for this job to be the director of the Estuary Program. Before that, I was working in Washington, D.C. for NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. So I was doing ocean conservation work, but at a very high level, at the national level, and which is very interesting. But you don't get to have that feel of being able to work with folks on the ground to make real concrete change. And so I was looking for a change, and I found one here in the Central Coast. And it's great because I get to go to work and do things like work with ranchers to fence cattle out of streams. And we've actually fenced 65,000 feet of stream with the program, and that's, you know, roughly the distance between Morro Bay and San Luis Obispo.
Wow.
So, and that's really helpful for water quality. It keeps bacteria levels down, and a whole suite of other benefits come from that.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX. I'm Marisa Waddell, and my guest is Adrienne Harris, who's the executive director of the Morro Bay National Estuary Program. The NEP is not a regulatory agency, right?
No, we're not. People get confused sometimes. They think we're a regulatory agency, or they think that we're a government agency. We are a not-for-profit organization. We're a 501c3, but we do have partnerships with government, the national government and state government. So I can see how people would get confused.
Okay. Tell me a little bit more about some of your specific projects. Restoration and conservation is one of the areas that you concentrate on. And I know that you have done some restoration of eelgrass. You've actually had folks plant eelgrass in the bay. What is so important about eelgrass? Eelgrass, by the way, is that sort of grassy-looking stuff that you see floating, especially around boat docks and things like that on top of the water. Why is it so important that you would have to plant eelgrass in Morro Bay?
So the Estuary Program has been tracking the health of the meadows of eelgrass in the bay since 2006. And eelgrass fluctuates over time, and we were tracking that. And unfortunately, in the last 5 years, we've seen a dramatic decline of eelgrass from about 300 acres that we had in 2009 to only 17 today.
Oh my gosh, what happened?
We're also asking that question. You know, when you're trying to track change in the environment, it's so difficult sometimes to point out what the one causing factor is from that. There are a number of factors that are probably at play here. One is that we have found evidence of a disease in the bay that has also attacked beds in Southern California and are now in Humboldt, too, actually attacking the eelgrass beds in Humboldt.
Hmm.
Algae growth in the bay, algae can grow much faster than eelgrass, and we've actually seen it smothering the eelgrass in certain places. Hmm. And when you see high algae growth in a estuary, you can kind of correlate that to some nitrogen levels in the bay. So probably there's something going on with the nutrient dynamics as well. So 17 acres is pretty discouraging to us, but we said we're not going to get discouraged because eelgrass can come and go and it naturally fluctuates. So if we give it a little boost, maybe it'll help come back to its more historic levels. And so last year we started a program to plant eelgrass in the bay. We did a pilot project in 2012, and then this year we did a more extensive planting. We planted over 9,000 bundles in the estuary this summer in August with 100 volunteers from the community. It was really great to see people from all walks of life, both bird hunters and bird lovers, there helping plant eelgrass.
And eelgrass is important to birds, I understand. Really important to a lot of creatures that actually eat it, right?
Yeah, so one of the reasons why that the birders are very involved in the project is because brant geese eat eelgrass, and they are one of the main species that like to hang out over winter in Morro Bay, and it's the main thing that they eat is eelgrass. But as I mentioned before, estuaries are such a diverse area, and eelgrass is what helps that. It's a key, what we call a keystone species. So that's just really saying it's a really important foundation of the whole ecosystem in the estuary. So lots of creatures are living in and on and eating the eelgrass, crabs, other small creatures, and the fish. There's so many different fish species that live in that area, both ones that we like to eat, that we catch commercially, but then others as well.
So you've protected over 3,000 acres of critical habitat for birds and wildlife.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to know where that is and how you did that and why it's important.
Mm-hmm. We feel excited that we've basically protected 1.5 times the size of Morro Bay in the watershed around it. So a watershed is really any drop of water that hits the land and ends up in the bay, that encompasses the watershed. And we have about a 75-square-mile watershed surrounding Morro Bay. Mm-hmm. So what we do in that land area impacts how healthy the bay is. Preserving natural habitats so it stays natural and is not become development or other things is very useful in water quality conservation as well as protection for various species. We put some conservation easements on some ranch property that's just outside of Morro Bay. And we've also purchased very little pockets of areas around. And I don't know if you're familiar with the Chore Creek Ecological Reserve, but that is an area that's owned by the Department of Fish and Wildlife at the base of Hollister Peak.
Mm-hmm.
And that is another large parcel that we helped purchase.
Okay. And do you work with other organizations, say like Small Wilderness Area Preservation, that Save the Elfin Forest and other groups like that in the area?
Yeah, so we also give out grants to small organizations that help do conservation projects. And SWAP, the Small Wilderness Area Preserve, is one of the groups that we've worked quite extensively with in the past. We've given them grants to help them with their work, in particular in the Elfin Forest. The Elfin Forest is a great area that's right along the bay. If people haven't visited, they should sure check it out. Beautiful natural oak area. That's what this area used to look like before we people and all of our various non-native plants showed up. And that very volunteer-based organization has helped keep that area natural and pristine.
Just one example of your partnerships.
Mm-hmm. We also do a lot of partnerships with the Land Conservancy of San Luis Obispo County when we're doing conservation easements or land purchasing.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas. I'm Marisa Waddell, and I'm talking with Adrienne Harris, who's the executive director of the Morro Bay National Estuary Program. And we're just discussing some of their projects and what they're doing to help keep Morro Bay healthy. You've also done a lot of restoration. I know hundreds of acres of degraded habitat have been restored by the NEP.
We do all kinds of things. We've helped restore creek habitat. So in our history of, especially in areas that have been farmed, we had a tendency to dike and straighten creeks, and that's not how they naturally want to be. And so we help go back in and make them more natural, and that does, again, help water quality and help create places for creatures to live. So we've gone in and done some restoration in Walters Creek in particular, which is in our watershed. Actually, if any of the listeners like to go to the gun club off Highway 1, we've actually restored some of the creek area through that area as well, through a partnership with Fish and Wildlife and the gun clubs.
So you mentioned that you had fenced, 65,000 feet of stream to protect from cattle. Tell me why that's important.
Cattle, you know, they're going to want to be where the water source is. And so a lot of times that's our creeks. And, you know, they're stomping around in the creek. They'll eat the vegetation. They'll trample the banks. They'll defecate in the creek. And so you see higher levels of bacteria You also can see some erosion and sedimentation from the cattle going in and out of the creek. And the species that normally live in our creeks, they like nice trees on the creek. It makes it cool and clear water. And so that kind of gets degraded over time if cattle do have a lot of access to streams. And so what we've been doing is partnering with landowners to actually fence in the creek. So the cattle can sometimes have access, you know, maybe for a couple of days a season, but not all the time. And so that allows all the vegetation along the creek to grow back, stabilize banks to keep them from being erodible, and keeps bacteria out. So it's a win-win for water quality for a number of factors that we track.
So that's one way that ag affects the estuary. What are some other ways that ag might affect the estuary?
You know, agriculture is so important for us. We've got this great bounty of fresh produce here in the Central Coast, but also there are some downsides to that occasionally. So farmers need to put pesticides and fertilizers on their crops, and we need to make sure that we're using the optimal amount of that, because any excess can then run off and into our waterways. And sometimes we see that. We like to work with farmers and ranchers to put buffers along waterways to help kind of keep those excess nutrients and fertilizers on land as opposed to going into the water. But sometimes you will see elevated levels of nitrates in particular in our creeks, which you could probably associate to farming. But there's all different sources for nitrogen. So sometimes it's hard to again, pick a specific source of a pollution issue if you see one.
So tell me about the relationship that the Morro Bay National Estuary Program has with local agriculture.
So we try and partner with various landowners who are interested in doing conservation projects. We can get grant money to help put in efforts that, you know, it'd be hard to raise all the funds privately, but we can bring in some funds to help partner, because we're bringing in the money to help protect the ecosystem as well.
Okay. It's Issues and Ideas. I'm Marisa Waddell, and my guest is Adrienne Harris, who's the director of the Morro Bay National Estuary Program. So we talked a lot about restoration and conservation, but you do a lot of studying and monitoring as well. Who's doing it, and what exactly are they monitoring?
Well, one of our most important monitoring programs actually is completely volunteer-based. I have two staff that help organize the project, but really it's an army of local volunteers, students, retirees, and others who are out there in the creeks every month and in our bay taking water quality measurements so we can see how clean is our water. That's one of the most important questions that we're asking. And those dedicated folks are out there every month taking those samples to tell us how much nitrogen do we see in the system, how much bacteria, what's, you know, all those various parameters that we're looking at.
And once you have those data, what happens to them?
So we track it over time to try and identify, you know, is there a specific area that we should try and focus a project? So the fencing example that we were talking about earlier is a good example where we saw high levels of bacteria, in particular in San Lucido Creek and along Highway 1. And we scratched our heads and we did some more monitoring, and we identified that maybe there was some cattle ranches that were maybe the reason that there was some higher bacteria. So we worked with the landowner there to put in the fencing project, and we did see bacteria levels decline. So that's one of the ways that we can take that information and help do good things for the environment.
So you can see direct links between your work and the monitoring that you're doing.
Yes, most of the time we can. You know, again, it's complex, so sometimes it's hard to piece together all the underlying factors. But for that case in particular, there was a very clear statistical correlation with that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, you have a MutMIT program as a part of your stewardship. Why are MutMITs so important to the health of the bay?
Well, so when you're walking your dog and considering whether you want to pick up after them or not, just think that if you leave that behind, that's lots of bacteria that are going to wash into the bay when it rains. And as I mentioned, we have oyster farmers in the bay. They're selling raw oysters to people to eat. So we definitely don't want folks to have to eat oysters that were grown in water with lots of dog doo-doo in it. So we want people to pick it up. And so that's another one of our volunteer activities. Volunteers go around the town and stock those dispensers when they get empty. And so visitors and locals alike can borrow a bag and make sure they pick up after their pet.
And that's all throughout the city of Morro Bay. Anywhere else in Los Osos too?
Yes, there's some in Los Osos as well.
And then you also have the Estuary Nature Center that you mentioned. Tell me a little more about that.
So it's right by our offices, and that's a place for visitors and locals to come and learn about what is an estuary and how can we protect it. And we have a great viewing platform if you want to borrow our binoculars and look at the bay itself, because there's so much life every day. Birds, sea lions, sea otters, all kinds of creatures that are just hanging out.
And again, tell me where the Nature Center is.
It's in Marina Square at the corner of the Embarcadero and Marina in Morro Bay. So if anyone knows where Windows on the Water restaurant is, it's right upstairs by there.
Okay. You're getting ready to start a fundraising campaign, and I'd like to know a little bit more about what your goals are.
So we are trying to diversify our funding source. We have historically had a lot of grants for the work that we do, but we also are looking for private support and looking for folks in the community to help support the work that we're doing for clean water.
Okay, so most of your money has come from national and state grants, I'm assuming?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, national and state grants, and the listeners that have been listening to national and state politics know that that funding source is ever-changing.
So you need a little more that you can count on from people maybe mm-hmm. right in the area who care about Morro Bay.
Yeah, we feel very strongly that this is still a time where we need to sustain the work that we're doing on the ground and maybe even grow into other areas.
What do you do with most of your funding that you receive?
So most of the funding that we receive is helping us do work in those three areas, conducting monitoring and various research studies in the Bay, as well as helping fund our restoration work and educating the public, doing education seminars. We actually, in April of next year, we're going to have a big State of the Bay event where we're going to roll out our report of how healthy the Bay's been over the last 5 years, and we're going to do a series of events for folks to learn more about what they can do to help.
And speaking of help, you have a lot of volunteers. Do you need more volunteer help? Are you always in need of ongoing volunteer help?
You know, we will take anyone who would love to come and help with the Bay. Right now, we don't have a big need for volunteers currently because, as you all have probably noticed, it hasn't rained a whole lot lately. And one of our biggest volunteer efforts, as I mentioned, was our monitoring program. And when there's no rain, there's no water in our creeks. So it's a little hard to monitor when there's no rain. So we're hoping that there'll be a lot more rain this winter because we sure need it.
Okay. Now, you have an open house coming up this Friday. Is it too late for someone to decide they want to come to the open house?
No, please stop on by. If you want to RSVP, you can call the office, but you can also just show up. It's at the same time as Art Night in Morro Bay, so you can come and visit us and then maybe go to some of the galleries.
Okay, so that's between 5 o'clock and 8 o'clock this coming Friday at the Morro Bay National Estuary Program office. And if someone wants more information about the Morro Bay NEP, how does one do that?
I would start with our website, and that's www.mbnep.org. So that's the acronym for Morro Bay National Estuary Program.
All right, great. Well, thank you so much. I've been talking with Adrienne Harris, who's the executive director of the Morro Bay National Estuary Program. I'm glad that you can come by.
Thank you so much. It was very lovely.
For Issues and Ideas, I'm Marisa Waddell.
And you're listening to Issues and Ideas on Public Radio KCBX, serving the Central Coast from Salinas to Ventura. Support for KCBX comes from Humankind Fair Trade, a nonprofit fair trade store featuring clothing and gifts handmade in developing countries. Humankind is located on Monterey Street next to Boo Boo Records in downtown San Luis Obispo. More information is online at humankindslo.org. Coming up at 2 o'clock, it's On Being. Robert Thurman and Sharon Salzberg helped bring Buddhism to America in the 1970s. She became a beloved meditation teacher, and he became a leading scholar of Buddhist philosophy and psychology. Krista Tippett talks with them as they explore a Buddhist take on the distinctly Christian teaching, love your enemies. Up next on Issues and Ideas, it's another installment of Ears on Art. Ears on Art is sponsored by Marshall's Jewelers, creating and selling fine jewelry since 1889. You can visit them on the corner of Higuera and Garden Streets in downtown San Luis Obispo.
Coming up on Ears on Art, a trip north to Toronto, Canada, and a meeting of SNAG, the Society for North American Goldsmiths. Stay tuned. Yeah. As I just stated, you are tuned in to Ears on Art, a segment of Issues and Ideas produced at the studios of listener-supported KCBX Public Radio. KCBX serves Southern Monterey, San Luis Obispo, and Santa Barbara counties on California's Central Coast. I am Stephen DeLuque. Co-host Krissa Hewitt traveled to Toronto, Canada to interview Gary Griffin, who received a Lifetime Achievement Award at a meeting of the Society of North American Goldsmiths. To quote the Society's website, the Lifetime Achievement Award is SNAG's highest honor and is presented to individuals who have made significant contributions to the field of metalsmithing. Recipients have distinguished themselves through significant accomplishments in teaching, advocacy, publishing, criticism, and related activities that expand and elevate our field. Mr. Griffin taught at the School for American Craftsmen at Rochester Institute of Technology from 1974 to 1984. He then went to Cranbrook Academy of Art in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan, where he was artist-in-residence and head of the metalsmithing department. Gary Griffin is also the recipient of two National Endowment for the Arts grants, and his work has exhibited extensively throughout the world. We now join Krissa for the first half of the interview.
Gary Griffin, hello.
Hello. It's good to be here.
And here, for all of you, is at our annual Society for North American Goldsmiths Conference, which this year is in Toronto. Gary has a very long history, not just with this organization, but with the whole discipline of metalsmithing, and this year was awarded the Lifetime Achievement Award.
And it is a remarkable honor to receive this, especially after knowing about those that have received it previous to me.
It is an impressive list, so congratulations.
Thank you so much.
How did you get into art, let alone metalsmithing?
I come from a family that had artistic inclinations and certainly a love of art. And as a boy, I was regularly taken to museums and to Indian pueblos. And my mother was a antique dealer and an interior designer, so I was very familiar with Louis XIV furniture and 18th century furniture and 19th century Victorian pieces. And so it was something that I think in some ways marinated in, but really only knew it as what my mother did or what my grandmother was interested in. And so let's just say it was not foreign territory. But I didn't really know that it was any different than anybody else's background or raising, how they were raised.
It is interesting when we go to somebody else's house, somebody else's whatever, and go, oh, mine's different.
Yes, exactly. My grandmother Griffin had a summer home in Taos, New Mexico, and from my first birthday through my 17th birthday, I spent every summer with her, which included all of her friends who were painters in the Taos area and mover and shakers of various sorts. And I basically knew what they did, but I really only knew them as my grandmother's friends and didn't really realize until much later what a really remarkable and unusual experience I had had.
Were they involving you in creating, or was it mostly just enjoying or observing what they were doing?
Well, my mother encouraged my grandmother to allow me to go to a studio in two different cases. One was with a ceramic artist, and I would go there once a week for a couple of hours and make some things or attempt to make some things. But the thing I remember the most was one summer I went the once a week, a couple of hours, to a colonial wood, Hispanic wood carver's studio. And I actually ended up with a chair. I think I was 13 years old. And of course, he helped me with all the joinery, but he insisted that I do the carving. He would lay it out. And so I learned carving rosettes and some of the aesthetic sensibilities of his work. I still have the chair.
Oh, good.
Yes, yes. So those kinds of experiences were very important in the sense that I like to make things and always did. And my mother provided me with a little work space in the garage, which most often included airplane models and things like that. But every once in a while, I'd get a crazy idea and try and build something. And sometimes it worked out to some degree, and sometimes it didn't. But my first experience with metal was very frustrating because it was far more difficult than wood, and you needed a very different tool vocabulary and skill set, and then tools, very different tools and things. Everything I had was either a wood saw or plane or something that was made for woodworking, and it was not fit for metal.
How did that metal experience come to happen?
There was a point where I decided that I wanted to learn to weld, and I actually went to a junior college trade program for a year. It was a two-year program, and we welded 4 hours a day, and then I would take other classes in the afternoon. Basically, when I left there, I wasn't a certified welder, but I was capable of getting a job as a welder. I received a job at Starkist Foods in their maintenance welding department. The maintenance departments of places like that are, they have a full machine shop. They've got everything to fix whatever breaks down in the cannery. That's where I learned a lot of machining skills, increased my welding skills, and I did that throughout college as a means of earning money.
And where was that?
That was in Long Beach, California.
Okay, somehow I didn't think tuna was necessarily in New Mexico, but...
No, it was in Long Beach, California. Well, they were canning fish on Terminal Island in the Long Beach Harbor at that point. That doesn't exist anymore.
And you were at Long Beach State?
I then went to Long Beach State College and enrolled in the Industrial Arts Program, which really was a place for training secondary teachers. And I liked that area because it was really a tool-based skill set place. But as I was proceeding through, I realized there's no design down here. They don't take that into consideration. They give you a set of plans and you make something. And I just felt something was missing. And at that point, I declared a dual major and took classes in the art department and in the industrial arts department. And it was in the art department that I found the crafts areas and then found metalsmithing. And I well remember that once I entered the art department and started taking 2- and 3-dimensional design, that there would be displays in the hallway of work of students. And when I saw the work that the metalsmithing program was putting out, and I saw teapots and raised vessels and all this jewelry, I just couldn't believe that someone actually made it, and thought, I need to inquire about that. So when I became eligible for those kinds of classes, I immediately enrolled, and the program was a rigorous one. It was very skill-based initially, along with design, and so they were giving you skill sets as well as design problems, and it fascinated me, it interested me, engaged me, and I just worked at it all the time. I loved it. Of course, that one thing led to another, and went through what I think was a really large arsenal of techniques and historical goldsmithing and silversmithing and even blacksmithing. And then I left and taught school for a couple of years in the public schools in Long Beach. But we knew that I would go to graduate school, and we took a trip across the country, visited a number of schools that we were interested in, and then in the end chose one, which I suppose was risky business.
And this was?
It was Tyler School of Art with Stanley Lexon. I was on the West Coast, And the work on the East Coast was so advanced and so adventurous. And I thought, this is what one should do. If you see something you admire, you should go for it and get over there and be with those people and soak it up. So I did.
Your story about seeing the displays in the hallways and stuff, I am a graduate of Cal State Northridge, and it was a similar experience of taking a summer school class in ceramics between kind of high school and starting college. And there was this small little case that had some jewelry in it. I stuck that in the back of my head, and I went off to UC Davis for 2 years and then transferred and wasn't able to get into the art classes right away because they were so full. And then finally landed the one, and then my first instructor brought some of his work to school one day, and one of them was this little silver box. And I went, you can teach me how to make a box.
Yeah.
And I was hooked.
Yes.
And I can really identify with that sense of, whoa, you can do that?
Yes, exactly. And I think even today, to see a flat sheet become a volume, that suspends belief. And no matter how it's done, whether it's pressed or formed by hand or spun on a lathe, when you see the metal actually moving, and most people's experience with metal in terms of it changing form is when they wreck their car, and you see that mess in front of you, and you can't imagine how that can be changed or corrected, and that the material actually has plasticity is beyond most people's comprehension.
Well, Charles Luton Brain talks about copper squirting.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
It was just this wonderful image, but he's right, and we don't think of it that way even when we've been working with it a lot. That's not an adjective that gets put out there.
Precisely, and it's one of the things that really attracted me or continued to attract me about metal in particular was that as one moves through undergraduate experience and you're sampling a lot of things, you begin to establish what some people might call fit. And there's a point where there's a particular medium that seems to fit whatever your sensibilities are. And a comparison would be, it always bothered me that clay in particular was not willing to stay where I wanted to put it. And so, in other words, the metal required a very different skill set. But I like the fact that if I bent it, and I bent it in the place that I wanted to, that it was going to stay there. And even though, you know, there's a little bit of elasticity and it may spring back a bit, I knew how to deal with that. But I knew it would be there and that it wasn't going to slump over or decide that because of certain gravitational forces that it was unwilling to do what I asked of it. And that appealed to me.
If you have just tuned in, you are enjoying the first of a two-part interview with the Society of North American Goldsmiths Lifetime Achievement Award winner for 2013, Gary Griffin. This program is Ears on Art, produced at the studios of listener-supported public radio KCBX on California's Central Coast. We now join co-host Krissa Hewitt and Gary Griffin discussing the various attributes and challenges of the different materials.
Again, I can identify with that one a lot because I was in the early stages, of course, learning how to throw on the wheel, and that was all very exciting, and I loved it at first, and then all of a sudden it was, wait a minute. Right. It's controlling me a lot more than I seem to be able to control it.
Right.
Now I use clay for its spontaneity.
Mm-hmm.
And if it takes more than half an hour to work a piece, that's too long.
Right. Precisely. I think that's one of the things that that even though metal can be appear to be very gestural and very spontaneous, that in effect that's what it can represent, but that's not actually how it got there. It was a far more planned process, and one that was required a certain number of steps to get there. It's a different kind of response. I think there's a point, though, that once one really develops some level of expertise or fit, whatever you want to call it, that it doesn't seem cumbersome anymore. You just know that it takes time. And one of the things I've always really liked about the material is that it can exist in different states of matter. It can be a solid or it can be a liquid. So in other words, you can mold things and cast into it. You can also subtract, and you can displace, which is a really unusual characteristic. In other words, you can take a cube of material and you can hammer it into a sheet, or you can draw it into wire. So in other words, you can completely displace the same amount of material. That's a very unusual characteristic.
It is. Talk about the similarities and differences as you've worked initially with welding and then moving into precious and semi-precious metals and back and forth.
I like the idea that there's the periodic chart, basically, and the metals are pretty, most of it. And there's this vast array of materials, precious, base metals, and they all have very interesting characteristics and may be useful for different kinds of operations. I know that when I did work with gold, that it amazed me at how malleable it was and how far it could be extended out of a half an ounce of gold, how much territory you could cover. And of course, there's so many historical examples. Every culture had used this material in one form or another and spread it all over their masks and their bodies and everything else, and in some cases their buildings. The thing that really, I think, in some ways allowed me a lot of territory to move from was I was always interested in technique and never really ashamed to be curious technically. I'm a technical geek, but I'm also very interested in the intellectual side of it and the plastic and the poetic side. But when new things came along or new opportunities in terms of technical interests, I always followed them. And so hammering is hammering. There obviously is a different way to handle a piece of silver than there is a piece of steel, but it's still hammering. And I mean, I have racks of hammers you just wouldn't believe, and they're segregated. You know, these are for over here and these are for over here. They don't really cross over into different metals. You know, if you're dealing with polished hammers, you don't want to be hammering a piece of hot steel with the scale on it. But the plasticity is comparable in materials, and it's just sometimes the material has to be hot and sometimes it has to be cold. And an example would be if you hammer sterling silver, it hardens as you hammer it, but if you hammer pewter, it softens. And it you know, there are inherent characteristics in these metals once you adjust for that, but you're still hammering.
Even in the welding, which you were doing early on, as compared to what we call soldering in the metalsmithing world, which is it more legally brazing than soldering by definition?
Yes,
but anyway, those differences for you, I mean, was it hard to make some of that adjustment?
Well, I think it depends on how you look at it. But if you look at it as joining, and that you take two pieces of metal and you join them together, they're different technically, but they're still joining. And I think the major difference is that the welding technique is actually a fusion. So you take two pieces of material and you fuse them together. So that joint is essentially the same material. Whereas in brazing, it would be more comparable to adhesion. In other words, it would be comparable to a bond, an adhesive bond. And it could be an excellent one. For example, when you happen to glue your fingers together with super glue, you've got a bond that's really a problem. And but it's different than when your skin grows back together, which is comparable to fusion. So the idea of joining, I knew things could be joined, and I think that soldering in particular is immensely challenging. I can give you an example. If you are soldering sterling silver all day, and you're dealing with solder that melts in the territory of 1300 degrees, and then you decide you're going to solder platinum, well, you're in a different territory altogether because you've got to go up to 2000 degrees. That is a big move. And usually when you go back to sterling, then you melt everything because it's at 1300. And so there's an adjustment. And that's really one of the wonderful things about craft is that it's a physical and a very much a body experience. In other words, you have a torch, you have this material, and you're looking at what's happening, you're smelling what's happening, you're feeling heat, you're looking for any kinds of signs for this solder to begin to flow. And you not only have to keep your eyes on that little piece of solder, but you have to know where the extended flame of the torch is, because usually beginners, they will be so focused on that solder line that the envelope of the flame will melt another end of the piece. And so there's a real sophistication in the vision that develops, in the hand-eye coordination. It's craft, and is a really remarkable experience, and something that's it's actually unusual to know about it.
Use of all of our senses, and that we're often thinking that we're only involved with one or something. Okay, mm-hmm. Well, I just have to look at this. But what are you looking at? You're looking at color, you're looking at sure. flux consistency, you're looking at all sorts of things, and you better be paying attention.
That's right. You better be paying attention. Yeah, that's, and I think it's true of a lot of the routines or the processes we go through. When you're buffing, you can really destroy something. Or even if you're using a belt grinder, whatever tool it is or whatever means of subtraction, you have to be able to sense when it's cutting. Because if it's not cutting, there's going to be a problem. You're going to roll an edge or lose a piece or something. And what I think is remarkable about that is that somehow through the ends of your fingers and in combination with your eyes, you know when something is happening or not. It could be the spark that comes off and you look at it and it's not right. That's a very physical and, I suppose, even poetic experience.
Somehow it gets more poetic all the time, I think, as I, you know, maybe I just get more tuned into it, but it's also as I attempt to explain a process to somebody who's wanting to learn it, and then you're recognizing all this wealth of years of doing something.
Right.
And how do I translate that?
Well, I think the first part of that is you have to restrain yourself, because you know, after so many years of experiencing something, one becomes aware that there are developmental cycles, and of course you can readily remember your own. That you too broke saw blades and you too melted things, and so this person that may be asking questions of you regarding these processes is most likely at an earlier stage, and you don't want to unload your wagon on them.
No.
You know, you start out with something really simple, really basic and limited, so that they have a one thing that they can concentrate on. And then once they start to get a better sense of that, then you can add something else. But I think restraint early on is really, really important.
It's a fascinating challenge,
exactly.
I find, because, yes, I certainly remember melting things. I still break saw blades. I still melt things. And yet, at the same time, there's an awful lot that is now second nature that I don't really remember that shift.
Precisely. It becomes intuitive. Not unlike driving a car, how many people actually think or identify that they're putting on the brake or pushing on the gas, or for that matter, where they're going? How often are we going down the highway and then suddenly we turn and we realize, well, we're not going home, we're going here, we're going to the market. In other words, we go into remote, which is a deep level of intuition. And I think that any of these processes we're in as we advance become very intuitive, whether it's annealing something or whether it's even selecting materials. You know what to look for, and you are being cautious about certain things that someone less experienced would overlook.
Co-host Krista Hewitt and I would like to thank today's guest, Gary Griffin, the recipient of the Society of North American Goldsmiths Lifetime Achievement Award for 2013. We will continue our discussion with Mr. Griffin on next week's program. But if you would like, you may find out more information about SNAG and Gary's award and work at the website snagmetalsmith.org. In an unusual collaborative exhibit at the Santa Barbara Museum of Art is the work of photographer John Divola in a show titled As Far as I Could Get. This is the first overarching presentation of Divola's work and is a collaboration between the Santa Barbara Museum of Art with concurrent exhibitions at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art and the Pomona College Museum of Art. Mr. Divola's exhibit runs until January 12, 2014 at SBMA. The museum is open Tuesday through Sunday from 11 a.m. until 5 p.m., and there is a charge for admission for non-members. Their website is sbmuseart.org, and the museum is located at 1130 State Street in downtown Santa Barbara. This has been a presentation of Ears on Art, a segment of Issues and Ideas produced and recorded at the studios of listener-supported public radio, KCBX, serving the California Central Coast from Salinas to Ventura. I am Stephen DeLuque. Please join us next week as Krista Hewitt returns to Toronto, Canada, to continue her conversation with Gary Griffin.